Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome to the podcast, and thanks very much for joining me. I just finished talking with Li Song Liu about his new book, Chinese Student Migration and Selective Citizenship: Mobility, Community, and Identity Between China and the United States. This came out in 2016 with Routledge Press. And I'm particularly excited to share this with you, in part because this is a book that gives historical grounding and a kind of voice to animating some really important conversations that are happening in and around the academy right now. And though the book focuses on the relationship between China, Chinese student migration, and the U.S., its issues, at the points that it's making, the arguments in the cases really speak much more broadly, I think, to phenomena and migration and universities beyond the U.S., at least to a more broadly North American context, if not well beyond. So it's a rather extensive conversation, and I'll keep this relatively brief so that you can get right to it. But I'll just say one of the really important kinds of work that the book does, just to expand on what I've just said, is to take a deeply transnational approach to understanding not just the legislation around the history of the sort of major kind of macro historical phenomena of migration and student migration specifically from China to the U.S. specifically again, but it uses these very sensitive case studies to speak to larger issues of how we understand citizenship, how we might use our stories about citizenship to give more agency to and to acknowledge the agency and the active choices made by immigrants themselves. It also speaks really importantly, I think, to some very important contemporary debates around North American universities and international students, and especially issues around the treatment of international students as a source of revenue and all of the implications that come from rising numbers of international student recruitment to North American universities and the responsibilities that universities are or are not doing the most to embrace in terms of caring for, nurturing, and really setting up a situation for international students so that they can best flourish in North American universities. So there's a lot of really important issues around the particular case that Li Song is studying, and I hope that you enjoy as much as I did. Thank you as ever for listening to the channel and for your support, and here we go. I'm here today to talk with Li Song Liu about his new book, Chinese Student Migration and Selective Citizenship. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Li Song, and thank you so much both for making time to talk with me today and for writing a book and giving us a case study about an issue that's of really primary importance to many of us right now. So welcome to the channel, and thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much, Connor, and thanks for your interest in this project, and it's really an honor to be included in this project.
Well, thank you so much. So, Li Song, let's start out as at the beginning, as is kind of traditional for the channel, and talk a little bit about how you came to the field. So what brought you specifically to modern history, to the modern history of China, and to a modern history of China that takes such a deeply transnational approach?
Right. I started studying Chinese history back in China, and I studied modern Chinese history and U.S.-China relations. Then I came to the United States in 2001 for my PhD at the University of Minnesota, where I had the fortune to study with the leading immigration historians. And because immigration is fundamentally a transnational and interdisciplinary project, so I got to study Chinese history from this particular perspective. And my book is about student migration. I think that's based on my long-time interest in the educational exchanges between China and the United States, and also in the political history, but it's also based on my exposure to the social and cultural history that I was immersed in during my graduate school training in Minnesota. So I would say my book is a political and a cultural history of China, of modern China, particularly in the last 3 decades. And I try to collect Chinese history with American history, particularly in the Asian American history, because that's what I was trained for. The Asian American communities and the Chinese American history post 1965 Chinese America in the United States. So that's how I started this project, the Chinese student migration to the U.S. after China started its reform in 1978.
Great. Thank you so much. So you've already very generously told us a little bit about what brought you to this particular project in the context of the larger entree into the field that you work in. So let's talk a little bit about what produced this as a book object. So this project actually started out, as you just mentioned, as a dissertation project. So
right.
Let's talk about that transformation. In the transition from dissertation to book, were there any important ways that the way you were shaping the project, the way you were conceptualizing the project, or really anything important to you about the project importantly changed from one stage to the other?
That's right. I think it's might have been the same for many, many people. The process has been quite interesting, exciting, but also painful.
Yeah.
Right? Transforming the dissertation into a book. And particularly in my dissertation, in the process, I kind of changed half of the dissertation when I revised it into the book. I added 2 new chapters. One was about the educational program, the internationalization of education, and the impact of international education on China and on the American higher education. So that's totally a new chapter, and it's based on the suggestion I got during my defense. That's a very important moment. And luckily, my dissertation committee members, they were very generous, and they told me that there might be something missing in my dissertation, which would be the educational institutions in both China and the U.S. So I added this new, totally new chapter into the book. I also kind of wrote a new chapter, the first chapter on the 4 waves of student migration, which I think is a natural process, because after finishing the dissertation and after teaching for several years, after continuing the research on the subject, I started to think about the different the periodization of student migration, which I think I did a little bit in my dissertation, but not so comprehensively and so clearly. So in this first chapter, I historicize the 4 waves of Chinese student migration to the United States, together with the context of U.S.-China relations and also the changes both in China and in the United States. So those 2 chapters are quite new. And then I kept the other chapters, but the last chapter, the selective citizenship, that's a lot of interesting story, I think, concerning the transformation of the dissertation into the book. In my dissertation, I had the general idea that I would like to talk about this transnational citizenship. So transnational citizenship was the term I used in my dissertation. And you can see it's pretty general. It's vague too. Even though I use that concept to challenge the conventional framework of immigration studies and the assimilation model. But I think by just using transnational citizenship, that term, there's something more, deeper in and more complex in for us to understand what this transnational citizenship really means. So I guess maybe in the second or third year of my teaching here in Pennsylvania, I was revising that in the last chapter of my dissertation, the chapter on transnational citizenship and the return migration, into a journal article which was published in 2012. Then I was thinking about this. Maybe I should rethink what this transnational citizenship meant. And in the end, I came up with the selective citizenship, which finally becomes a key theme in my whole book and also the part of the title of the book, which I think helps us to understand that it's not just the transnational, but it's about people's mobility across national boundaries, but also about their limitations, about their choices, about how they very consciously and skillfully adapted to immigration policies, nationality laws, and to find their own identity and find their own membership. So that's one interesting story in the process of transforming the dissertation into the book, I guess. That basically started the whole new arguments of the book. But of course, besides this concept about citizenship, then I rethought the impacts of the rise of China and even the surge of the Chinese students in the United States. I graduated in 2009. So at that time, I was most interested in the return migration part. that's why I revised that chapter into a journal article. But in these recent years, as we all know, the number of Chinese students really skyrocketed even more. And also the concept of the Chinese dream, right, which was raised and popularized, particularly after 2012, officially endorsed by the Chinese government, but also it led to public and intellectual academic discussions both in China and in the US. So that concept, that term, Chinese dream, then led me to rethink the book, the project. And so in the end, I think my book has been trying to problematize both the Chinese dream and the American dream. And then in that process, I collected all these different chapters, making them more coherently. For example, the first chapter, I talked about the different waves and then the transformation of the American dream and then what the Chinese dream meant for this most recent wave of Chinese student migration. And then the second chapter, the educational reforms, it's also about how Chinese and American educators, they understood either the Chinese dream or the American dream and the national identities and the role of international education in both societies. And then the other chapters about immigration policies, migrant communities, and then selective citizenship. So I think it's a great process. I really enjoyed it, even though, as you know, after the publication of the book, I thought, oh my goodness, that's a really long process. But it's a very interesting one. I think it's the process in which I gradually realized what's the real theme of the book, along with the development in the world, in China and in the US, and what concerns us most. And then I incorporated those contemporary concerns into my revised project.
That's great. Thank you. And I think one of the things, and so we're going to move to this issue of the American dream and the Chinese dream in a moment. But first, I'll just mention something and then kind of set a little bit of context. And the thing I'd just like to highlight among the many really interesting things that you just said about the process right. is the importance at that stage of the defense of the dissertation, right? For graduate
That's
students
right.
who have the opportunity to do that. And not all PhD programs actually do have a defense, but for those
right.
that do, both for colleagues of ours who are listening, who are involved in the process of helping conduct the defense, right, for professors, for chairs of committees, but also for graduate students who may be looking ahead to that process. It's so important. It can be so helpful and transformative for a project to integrate into that conversation, right, some attention to and some attentiveness to what could help transform the dissertation into a book manuscript. And so because not all dissertation defense processes explicitly address that, I think you're really helping to make an argument for the importance of doing that, because it really can help a writer transform a project. And it's really a rare opportunity to get a bunch of people in the room to help do that. But so let's get right into it. So what I'll do is just say a few things just to kind of set the stage, and then we'll dive right into the first chapter. So and I'll just kind of summarize some of the stuff that's happening in the introduction for listeners who haven't had a chance yet to see the book and read it. So the introduction opens at the very beginning by telling us or reminding us that since the inception of open door and reform policies in 1978 in China, more than 3 million Chinese students have been sent abroad, and most frequently to the U.S. Now, the book is going to look at the historical contexts in which that happened in order to inform how we think about both the history and contemporary practice, and perhaps to look into the future. Now, it analyzes the impact of China's economic, political, and educational reforms. It looks at the importance of changing relations between the U.S. and China, and it considers the transformations in Chinese-American communities, American immigration law, and race relations that came with the transformation of students to migrants, with a relatively high, relatively speaking, right, and sometimes absolutely speaking, professional and socioeconomic status. It also looks at migrants' own, in the words of the book here, transnational networks, cultural hybridity, and interpretations of citizenship. The book is going to argue, and we're going to get to this in a moment, that student migration, again, in the words of the book, embodies the persistent but transformed American dream in China. So let's get to that dream. And we get there kind of deeply and in a very focused way in chapter one. Chapter one, and again, I'll just kind of set the stage here and then open it up to you. Chapter one offers a brief but very focused and very, very helpful history of Chinese students studying abroad, especially studying abroad in the U.S. It divides student migrations post-1978 in the way that you've just described just a few moments ago into four major waves, and looks at the changing meanings of the American dream in each of these waves. So the first wave was 1978 to the mid-1980s. The second wave was the mid-1980s to the early 1990s. And in the second wave, you talk about the impact of Tiananmen Square, right, and the Tiananmen Square incident. The third wave is the mid-1990s to early 2000s, and the fourth wave is the early 2000s to the present. And in this fourth wave, you talk about the significance of September 11th, the September 11th incident, and also, and this is really important, I think, to a lot of listeners right now, you talk about the significance of the issue of air pollution in helping to shape this. And that's, I think, a really interesting way that the study dovetails with environmental histories and those kinds of concerns. Mm-hmm. Now, there are several arguments that this chapter is making, but I want to go right to an issue that you've already brought up and ask you to expand a little bit more on it. Mm. So in addition to showing that the myth of the American dream has been constructed differently in each of these waves, you talk about the ways that the current surge of student and professional migration reveals, this is in the words of the book, the dilemma of the Chinese dream. An increasingly wealthy and powerful China ironically can't retain its own citizens or convince migrants to reclaim it as their home. So can you maybe open up what you see as the most important aspects for you of this chapter by taking us into what you see as most important about this Chinese dream and the work that it's doing here?
Right. That's a great summary. Thank you, Carla.
Oh, thank you for making it so clear.
I think a few things. One is the historical root of the American dream, which I have tried to highlight in the chapter. And it's particularly interesting because I As you know, when we wrote this kind of book manuscript, we usually send them to colleagues, friends, for critics, for comments. And a few times I got the feedback that 30 years, the four waves, it might be a challenge, right, to historicize contemporary history. So hopefully I have my historicization of this Chinese student migration since the late 1970s is effective. But I think the four different waves, the continuing waves, but also very distinctive waves, I think they prove that how much China has changed, even in just 30, 40 years. And also, the American dream, as I put in the book, has been reinvented in a sense that following the historical pattern, the United States has always been viewed in two ways, which complement each other, constitute each other. One is that the United States is a model, right? It's admirable. But the other image is it's resentful because it exploited the Chinese people in history as one of the imperialist powers. And at present, it has been viewed as curtailing China's rise. So I try to analyze, contextualize this American dream in a context of Chinese student migration to see how students as a particular group understood this American dream. And this American dream, then my chapter argues, is not really about the United States. It's really about what happened in China and about the concerns of the students themselves about their own identity and their own perception, their own aspirations. So, for example, the first wave from the 1970s to the early 1980s, it's a wonderful year for the United States and China to establish, to normalize their diplomatic relationships. So students, and at that time, many state-sponsored scholars, they rediscovered the United States. And along with that, very romanticized image of the United States. Then the second wave was marked by the political unrest in the late 1980s, as you mentioned, including the Tiananmen Square incident, when students advocated American democracy, and they sought refugee and settlement in the U.S. And then the third wave, I think things changed in China, right? China, after the 1992, Deng Xiaoping toured southern China, kind of pushed forward China's economic reform, and China experienced this long term economic development, and people also got more opportunities to go abroad and to understand the United States. So the American dream was upheld, but it was less generalized or romanticized as in the past two waves. And it was also complicated by the growing national pride among the Chinese, including the students. And then the last wave, with a very interesting pattern, as I mentioned earlier, with the skyrocketing number of students, including younger students now, who had more financial resources based on China's economic development. And many of them, in fact, came abroad with the intention to be in the bridgehead of migration for the family, for the family of the new rich. And also, there was tremendous anxiety in the Chinese public about the quality of life, like air pollution, as you mentioned earlier, and food safety and public morality. So this most recent wave, I think it's very interesting. It's still unfolding, and we don't know how public sentiments may change. But I think it shows that, again, the perception of the United States among the Chinese, particularly the Chinese students, are defined not by what happened in the United States, but what happened in China. And in that sense, the rise of China has not really negated the deeply rooted American dream.
Great. Now, as there's a lot more that we could talk about in the context of chapter one, but there are lots of other chapters. So as we move to chapter two, I would just want to mark for listeners that there's a lot of really wonderful discussion in chapter one that they'll find in the book of all of these individual stages and the factors that you've talked about at much more length. But in chapter two, we move to a really interesting study of the study abroad industry in China. This is really, really fascinating. Now, this is a powerful force, as you show in this chapter, that shapes both Chinese student migration and also related notions of this American dream we've been talking about. Now, the initial part of the chapter focuses on an analysis of an organization called the New Oriental School. Now, for listeners who are not familiar with this industry in China, right, can you very briefly explain what is this New Oriental School, and in what ways for you does what's happening here sort of encapsulate the most important things that you would hope we would get out of this chapter?
Right. Yeah, and the New Oriental School is a very interesting case. I guess if you ask any Chinese students on American campuses, I would say most of them know about this school. It's possibly the oldest and the largest English language test and a study abroad preparation service in China. I think it was founded in the early 1990s as a family-run business by Yu Minghong, and then it expanded in the next decades. And I started my chapter with a film based on this New Oriental School, its success, 中国合伙人, which was released just a few years ago when I visited China a few years ago, visiting my family, and I watched this film back in China. So I could really sense how popular and successful that film was. And the film depicted a similar company. Of course, based on this New Oriental School case, the founders, very young, very ambitious, and they had kind of romanticized American dream, as I mentioned earlier, possibly in the 1980s. So the founders belong to the generation who were tremendously affected by the Enlightenment movement, the democratic movement in China late 1970s and early 1980s, up to the late 1980s. So they admired the West, and because they really wanted to modernize China at that particular moment, so they even advocated kind of for Westernization. And so the founders of the New Oriental School, I placed them in this historical context. But at the same time, I argue that the success of the school was fundamentally based on this myth of the American dream, and the American dream they advocated. But at the same time, the interesting thing is they also needed to face the challenge of the rising nationalism in China. For example, in 1999, the NATO-led bombing of the Chinese embassy in Yugoslavia. And at that moment, there were nationwide protests against NATO, against the United States. And then the New Oriental School, because it was the largest training service and encouraging students to go abroad, particularly in the United States. So it was targeted, and it had to find ways to defend itself. So in that context, it sided with the official standpoint that we should still remember the history of China's national humiliation. So all that national sentiment, nationalist sentiments at that moment. So, and the second chapter really describes this interesting tension between this deeply rooted American dream, and then the changing public mood, complicated by the changing U.S.-China relations on the diplomatic crisis like that. I guess the rest of the chapter talks about the response of Chinese educators towards international education, particularly the joint programs of increasingly popular and the increasing trend of Chinese students studying abroad. And I pointed out that the Chinese educators' attitude has been quite ambiguous. On the one hand, they hope that there can be more market-based, well, maybe not market-based, but more freedom for Chinese educational institutions to develop, to be free from state intervention or state domination. But on the other hand, they are also very sensitive about this educational sovereignty or cultural identity of China. And so they argue that there might be a certain need to retain the role of the Chinese state in battling against the power of excessive capitalism and symbolized by the market of international education, also to battle against Western influence. So that's something very interesting, I guess, we can see in the, along with the increasing international education in China and this increasing trend of studying abroad. Then the second half of the chapter deals with the American side, including both the efforts of American government as well as higher education institutions in recruiting international students. I guess this might be most well-known, best known now, as to when in academia, we know many American universities, colleges, they have been trying hard to send people abroad, admissions officer abroad, or agencies abroad to recruit international students, particularly Chinese students.
That's right.
Because of the fiscal pressure after the economic recession in 2007.
We have that in Canadian universities as well, actually. I think
that's right.
Yeah, it's a broadly North American.
That's right. And also European universities, I guess, the same. Because I attended International Education Fair in China a few years ago, and I saw all their exhibition halls sponsored, in fact, by Malaysian government embassy in China and also British embassy in China. So there has been this very intense competition among nations to recruit international students, of course, for its financial gains. But in a US context, historically, we know educating Chinese students has been a very important dimension of American policy towards China. So this chapter points out these dual dimensions for American government and higher education institutions to recruit Chinese students, both for financial gains and for its cultural and diplomatic missions.
That's right.
Right.
Oh, sorry. So, and also just to kind of mention for listeners, and then we can maybe move to the next chapter, which looks at legislation of immigration, which is also a really important part of this. Another really important focus of chapter two for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it is also the increasing phenomenon of American branch campuses.
That's right.
Abroad. And that's another. So these two issues, right, are these the increasing efforts to encourage international students and Chinese international students in particular to study at American universities to a large extent because of the financial gains that the universities are making, you know, as a result, and also the phenomenon of branch campuses. I think any of us, right, like anyone listening to this and any potential or actual readers who have a personal involvement in academia right now, who have any family or friends or colleagues who are working in academia, who are themselves studying in academia, will recognize these as very, very hotly debated, active issues animating a lot of conversation in and around the university right now in a lot of different ways. And certainly at UBC, my home institution, there's a lot of conversation about this, about the consequences, about the kind of relative fairness of the different tuition rates, right? And rising tuition rates for international students and the kind of equity issues that involves. So there's a lot of really interesting conversations around the really important work that this chapter does.
That's right. And then, sorry, because I do... because you mentioned this very important part, and I do hope I can mention kind of the contemporary concern based on this chapter, because with this increasing number of international students, I guess there have been debates, also controversial images, or even stereotypes against international students too. So so I surveyed the Chronicle of Higher Education report the opinion articles about international students. So there has been a trend in the first decade of 2000s after the terrorist attacks. So in the first years, American educators were worried about the decreasing number of international students, right? But then in mid 2000s, with the increasing number of the pickup of the number of international students, then the major concern started to become the anxiety or the impacts on American academic integrity or academic freedom or American values. So I would like to highlight here because it's one of the kind of civic missions of the book that we need to really respect these international students, not just treating them as financial resources, but also as individuals, as equals. And also, I think American educators are faced with similar to their counterparts in China, who had the dilemma of balancing the role of the state, right? In either securing more freedom from the state for educational reform, but also retaining the role of the state in the battle against capitalism and Western influence. I think for American educators, they are faced with the difficult tasks of challenging, again, the deeply rooted American exceptionalism. Because when they talk about American academic integrity, American academic freedom, when they stereotype international students, they tended to, again, glorify the American dream, American exceptionalism as different, and the need to upgrade international students to fit our system. I guess that's one point I'm not comfortable with, and I really hope that our world and the academia can think about the best ways to treat and respect and incorporate international students. And also, I think American educators or any educators in any nation, possibly more in the American context, I think they face the challenge of decentering the American state in its encompassing power in directing foreign relations and international exchanges. Again, I guess that's something very deeply rooted in what's the mission of educating foreign students in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you so much for articulating that. And I think it's really, really important. And it really is a great example of the very, very important way that the book is speaking to and can help inform some extraordinarily important conversations we're having in and around universities now, including, given this increasing and vibrant push to encourage international student enrollment right. at our universities, what responsibilities do we have as faculty and as universities to care, you know, in our duties of care for international students and to make sure that we're giving our international students the resources to do well and to flourish at our mm-hmm. universities, mm-hmm. which doesn't always feel like it's the case.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So thank you for that. And I hope that we can continue these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So as we move to the next chapter, strictly because of limitations of time, we won't have time to get into too much detail, but I just want to mention for listeners, this is a really important chapter. Chapter 3 looks at the changing immigration status of student immigrants. It takes us into the nature and the impacts of two major legislative measures that shaped these changes. The first one mm-hmm. Centers on the 1992 Chinese Student Protection Act, and you talk about the ways in which this can be understood largely as a kind of political campaign, right, that sort of idealizing the U.S. at the end of the Cold War. And you also take us into the implications and really the lived experiences of individuals who are dealing with these changes, which is really, really important. The creation of the H-1B specialty worker visa in 1990 and its expansion thereafter. And student migrants had some really challenging and painful experiences with these and related procedures and policies. And this chapter really takes us into those and helps us hear some of the voices coming out of that so that we can understand, again, the impact of these legislative changes on the larger narrative arc of the book, but also on the individuals that the book is helping us to hear and understand a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll kind of leave that there, but is there anything briefly before we move on that you feel is crucial for us to understand about that chapter that you just want to highlight briefly for us?
Mm-hmm. I will make it also briefly. I know we have that time concern,
okay.
but
that's okay.
Right. I think it's, when I wrote this chapter, when I revised the chapter, I kept up with the immigration debates. That's the beauty of immigration studies, I guess, even as a historian, because it's constantly going on and we constantly got all the feedback, all the comments, very complicated comments from the public around us. So this chapter talks about, as you said, the immigration policies, especially in the H-1B debate, which is still ongoing. And also the concern among migrants themselves about the need to reform American immigration policies, especially the long wait of the long wait for certain national groups, such as the Chinese, the Indians, Mexicans, and the Filipinos. So I think one central argument in the chapter is that I think their long wait is not just a contemporary concern, because these national groups have been marginalized, discriminated, or even excluded in the past, historically. So I try to make this kind of historical parallel to say that we need to think about contemporary immigration policies, the 1965 immigration reform. It might not be as we regularly understand as so revolutionizing the immigration regime. It has retained certain discriminatory characteristics, patterns, especially concerning the difficulties for certain national groups to adjust their status.
Great. Thank you so much. So as we move from this to chapter 4, we move to a chapter that looks at the ways that student migrants built communities in local American society. And the chapter,
right.
It takes the Twin Cities in Minnesota as a case study. Now, this actually does at least a couple of different kinds of really, really interesting work, this focus on this particular locality. One of the kinds of work that it does and that you mention here in the chapter is that it allows the analysis to move beyond around what has otherwise been a very dominant narrative that tends to focus on the coasts and on California in particular, as you mentioned here, in Chinese and Asian American studies. So it relocates this conversation in an area that's not on the coast, and thus it brings a fresh perspective in that way. But you also mention here in the course of your analysis that part of your analysis comes from your own experience in Minnesota, right? Including, as you, in the words of the book, serving as the director of a community involvement at the Chinese Student Association during the graduate study that you undertook that produced this study at the University of Minnesota. So because this is a really interesting kind of moment in the study, so could you talk a little bit about how that experience kind of shaped your understanding of what's going on here in the chapter and also shaped your sense of what's perhaps most important for us as listeners and readers to get out of this chapter? Like, what's really important for you based on that experience for us to take away?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the service as the director of community engagement for the Chinese Student Association has been one of my best memories during my graduate school training in Minnesota. And with that advantage, I could interact with different community organizations, and I got tremendous support from community leaders, and particularly Mr. Wei Minlu, who is a prominent city planner and also wonderful community leader, both in Minnesota and in the nation. So I think this chapter describes Midwestern Chinese community, both in the larger context of the national patterns of changing Asian American communities after 1965, for example, the diversity, growing diversity of immigrants. For the Chinese migrants, now they are from different regions with different dialects and also different socioeconomic status, different residential patterns, and different identities, political, cultural, and religious affiliations. So that follows the national pattern. But on the other hand, I think the Midwestern context helps us to understand the different racial and political landscape, because in Minnesota, the demographic picture is really different from the demographic picture in California or in New York, where Chinese population has been a major, very important, a large part of the state, the population of the state. But in Minnesota, it's only 0.5% of the state population, very small. And also the Chinese population is not the largest among the Asian American communities. So that makes it a little bit interesting to see how the Chinese community identifies itself, positions itself in this interesting Midwestern context. I think the chapter also talks about a very important one important theme, which matches the larger theme of the book. That is, the transnational networks, in fact, help migrants to reflect on their local roots and even help them deepen their local roots. So I guess that's a coherent theme in this book, that when we talk about transnationalism, transnational networks, we may better not to idealize that, because there will be costs for transnational linkages. There are tremendous benefits, of course, right? And we need to understand the transnational networks and identities to challenge the deeply trenched nation-state based analytical framework in our studies of migration or any other subjects. But at the same time, we also need to understand the migrants' own concerns during the transnational process. For example, some migrants I interviewed, they traveled to China a lot in these past years, but they My last chapter will talk about the circular migration rather than permanent return. But for now, the migrant I just mentioned, he decided that he would not go back to China to settle down. That means that he decided to remain in the United States, American citizen. A major reason was the air pollution again. So he said he would not, he couldn't really live there. And also the social relationships, I guess he has been used to the lifestyle in the United States that he might not possibly feel comfortable back in China. But I think that's natural for any immigrant after a long time of residence abroad. So that's the last part of my chapter, emphasizing this interesting dynamic between transnational linkages and local route, because many migrants also feel like they traveled back and forth constantly, and that might have caused the lack of local engagement, which would be a very, very important part for their local identity, local rights. I guess this might be applicable to other immigrant groups too. So that's one major purpose of this chapter. I hope to kind of clarify the relationship between transnational and the local identities.
Thank you so much. And if we had another hour, there's a whole lot more that we could talk about, right, just in this chapter. And so I'll just mark this for listeners so that they know that this is there and they can go back to this when they have the book. The chapter also, in addition to doing all the kinds of work that you just mentioned, it's also showing the ways in which, with increasing numbers of student migrants becoming professionals, community dynamics have really changed. And it looks at some of the most important ways this has happened, including growing diversity and class bifurcation, the development of heritage schools, and you talk about Chinese language schools. You talk about this just fascinating description of changes in community newspapers, which is really interesting. It covers faith-based organizations like churches. It looks at family and gender relations in the lives and the family lives of students and professional migrants. And it also talks importantly, and again, I'll mark this and then we'll move on, about the important transition from considering one's identity as Chinese to considering one's identity in terms of Asian American. And you talk about your own experiences with this kind of transition as well. And so it's a really fascinating chapter for all kinds of reasons. And we could totally just spend like an hour just talking about this chapter. So listen.
Thank you very much.
Of course.
And here I do want to, because you mentioned another Chinese heritage and language schools, I do want to highlight a little bit, because I think it's also a very contemporary issue. And I hope we, as educators and as a citizen, I hope we can address and improve that. That is the importance of a foreign language study, teaching education in the United States or in any country, I guess. So there has been a remarkable increase, right, of Chinese language teaching in American public school systems. I have some data here. For example, a 2002 survey of American college and university courses showed that less than 3% of total enrollment in foreign language was in Chinese. And the number of the enrollment at American elementary and secondary schools was even lower, only 0.3%. That's in 2002. So that was a really an issue, I guess. Well, historically, but fortunately, there has been some change, especially after the 9/11 attacks, with the designation of certain languages, right, as strategic languages important for American national interests. So, but the change has not been enough. I would say, for example, there's another survey showing that in 2007-2008, the number of enrollment for Chinese in American K-12 public schools increased from about 20,000 in 2004 to about 60,000 in 2008. It was the largest growth rate among all languages, but Chinese still ranked very lower than the other popular languages like Spanish, French, German, Latin, and Japanese. And its share was still only 0.67%. So in 2008, I would like to highlight that to show that there has been some improvement, but not enough.
Well, thank you. And thank you for highlighting that.
Right.
So as we move to chapter five, this is another really fascinating chapter that we could probably talk about for an hour. This chapter looks at the increasing return and circular migration, and you just mentioned that a little bit, of student migrants since the mid-1990s. There's all kinds of fascinating things happening here, including a really interesting use of something called HighwayNet as a major source. So
right.
I won't talk too much about that, but I just want to mention for listeners, because this is one of the really interesting things happening in the book, is the integration of and the use of some really interesting sources, like source materials, for understanding some of these phenomena. Now, you show here that migrants often choose to travel between their two communities instead of returning permanently to China. You argue that this demonstrates some of their reservations about the Chinese dream, but also you look very carefully at this phenomenon in the chapter to try to challenge and upend some assumptions about the notion of dual citizenship or dual nationality. Now, the chapter, instead of this, the chapter is going to come back to something that you mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation. So it's really nice that we're going to sort of close with this as well, which is the notion that you're putting forth here for understanding this of selective citizenship. So it's inspired by the notion of flexible citizenship that listeners may be familiar from other kinds of works, the chapter instead proposes this idea of selective citizenship, among other things, to highlight what you call, here in the words of the book, migrants' resilience and creativity in claiming their own identities. So as a way of maybe bringing us to our conclusion, could you talk about this idea of selective citizenship maybe at a little bit more length? For you, what's most important about the work that this is doing here?
As I mentioned earlier, this term was kind of the theme of the book that I came up with a few years ago at night, at midnight. In fact, I still...
Isn't that how things go, right? In the shower or when you can't sleep?
I think in my case, it's more dangerous. I was walking back from my office to my apartment at midnight,
oh,
I think.
No.
And it was very dark. And I guess it was in the winter. I was at the traffic. It's a small town here, and then a car parked on the opposite of the street. I was thinking about what might be the theme of the book, the journal article, the chapter. Then I came up with this selective citizenship. I was so immersed in that concept that I forgot the environment. I was just walked crossing the street. And then the car was also approaching forward. So that's midnight, and that's dark, and that's in a small town, and the road. It's an interesting experience. But
academia is dangerous. It's dangerous to be a professor.
I really remember that particular moment. But anyway, so I hope this concept, I guess it's in some sense, it's not new. Because it's a time-honored strategy of migrants, right? They choose where they want to go, even though with a lot of limitations, and they choose what to identify with, again, based on a lot of historical traditions or contemporary concerns. On the other hand, I think this concept may be useful for us to understand first, for both nation states and migrants, they have this strategy. So nation states, they could design immigration policies to choose their desirable migrants. Particularly in my book, this highly skilled, educated migrants. But then for migrants, don't forget, they are also very strategic. They are also very, they have their own, agency and motivation and identity. So they could select their own strategies of migration, and they could select their own nationality. Secondly, I think this concept can help us rethink the concepts of like flexible citizenship or dual citizenship particularly, because for quite a while, I think in both public and academic settings, people have been talking about this advantage of flexible citizenship and also the attraction of dual citizenship. It's wonderful to be dual nationals. But as historians, we will ask the question first, how applicable, how feasible is that, right? Different nations have very different nationality laws, citizenship laws. And in the Chinese case, it has a very complicated history of adopting the sanguineous policy in the late Qing dynasty to claim all Chinese abroad, ethnic Chinese as Chinese nationals. The context was very complicated because at that time it was a response to the Dutch East India Indies, the Dutch policy in the East Indies, claiming Chinese there as Dutch subjects. So in 1909, the first Chinese nationality law then saying that all Chinese abroad should remain Chinese. So it's a response, reaction against imperialist claims. But then it changed later. Particularly in 1955, in a Cold War context, so the Chinese government decided to end this dual nationality law based on its sanguineness and instead chose the single nationality law. So in China, people cannot keep or claim two nationalities. Then how do they select? How do they choose nationality, citizenship? So that's one question I pose as a historian to this issue, nationality, dual nationality policy. And also for migrants, they also tend to choose their own identities. So it's not just about national membership, nationality, but their cultural identity. And then they can choose to be either American or Canadian, or they can remain Chinese. So it's their choice. And many of them made that very clear. So dual nationality, dual citizenship may not be feasible first of all, and nor desirable for many migrants. So I think those are the two dimensions of the dual nationality issue I would like to highlight in the book, particularly regarding the desirability of the dual nationality. My chapter highlights the long question in Southeast Asia, because that's where the majority of Chinese migrants reside and still remain at this moment, even though the percentage of Chinese migrants outside of China in Southeast Asia has decreased. In the past, it was more than 80-90%, but now it has decreased dramatically. But it's still the majority of Chinese migrants worldwide who stay in Southeast Asia. And for people there, they are still faced with the pernicious question, loyalty question, which has been very, very dangerous and very complicated to them in a Cold War context. And for many of them, they may not want to be claimed as both Chinese citizen and the citizen of the local state, the native, the local society, because that would make them, again, the target of the nationalist nativists. Mm-hmm. In the local society concerning their loyalty. So my chapter tries to highlight this very important and complicated dimensions of the dual nationality and the transnational citizenship question.
Great. So Lee Song, thank you so much. There's so much more that we could talk about, right? And we're at the end of our time now, but there's an epilogue and there's a whole lot more in all of these chapters. But
right.
Given that, and you know, given the fact that an interview like this can't possibly be comprehensive, and you know, we'll assume there's much more in the book. Still, is there anything in particular that we didn't mention, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
I think we have covered most of the major issues, and thank you for allowing me to expand on certain issues.
Oh, of course. No, thank you. I mean, this is just a demonstration of how vibrant and relevant the work that the book is doing to animate and to speak to some really, really important conversations right now. So speaking of ongoing conversations, now that the book is out, and congratulations on the book, what's
thank
next
you very
for
much.
You?
Yeah.
What are you currently working on and what's inspiring you?
Right. My next book project is about Chinese, the role of Chinese immigration in defining Chinese national identity and constructing Chinese understandings of race, modernization, globalization. So it's at this moment, I know it's a very general theme, but I think it will tackle the larger questions than, because I think that may be the pattern for the dissertation. It has to be very focused, right? Mm-hmm. And deeper and deeper. For the second book, I think I will continue some researching some subjects that I already studied in my book, such as the dual nationality law. But at the same time, I want to expand it to include a longer historical span from the mid-19th century up to now, and focusing on the nationalists and intellectuals' debates and discussions about migration, race, and national identity. I have written an article which I'm now revising, and hopefully I can send it to a journal soon. It's a study of other nationality laws from 1909, as I mentioned earlier, up to the 1980, the current single nationality law. And along with that, I studied how Chinese intellectuals and the nationalists, they compared Chinese immigration with other nations of immigrants. So that's another major theme I hope can be part of the book, which I think will be original and important, to compare different nations of immigrants. And my preliminary findings is that it's pretty comparable. China's immigration policies and the citizenship laws are quite comparable to other nations, such as including Italy and Mexico. And but at the same time, the comparison led to the Chinese nationalists' understanding that China is really different from other imperialist and colonial powers like Italy or Germany or the United States. Of course, the U.S. is not a nation of immigrants, but a nation of immigrants, as it claimed itself. But the difference is the Chinese nationalists viewed China as different from other colonial powers in treating in the sense that they are not, the Chinese are not exploiting or establishing colonies abroad. And so in that process, I would like to see how they conceptualize race and modernization, and how they define Chinese identity, national identity, based on this central role of immigration in Chinese history.
Well, that sounds great too. So best of luck with that, and I'll let you go
and
get to that. But thank you so much for making time. It's really been a pleasure, Lee Song, and thanks for giving us a book with such contemporary resonances as well as such historical sensitivity. Mm-hmm. Thank you
very much. And but in the end, I do want to thank my dissertation committee members for their generous support for my dissertation, and also then the book. They have been continuously advising me to improve the book. So Anne Watner, Erica Nee, Barbara Doug and particularly Donna Gabacha, including the next book project. Donna has been very, very generous in advising me in this kind of global and historical comparative frameworks.
Fabulous. Well, thank you for sharing that also. And thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.